So can you just say your name and spell it for me?
Terry Smith, TerrySmith.
And what year was you born?
1956.
And
morning.
When did you go to the sort of Leytonstone, Leyton area? Sort of what drew you there?
All my friends were living there. There's a, you know, because of the Acme Housing situation. So probably all my friends at one point were living somewhere in Leytonstone, Philibrook Road, Grove Green Road, you know, the whole area really.
And where was you living at the time yourself?
I was living in another Acme house in Bow. So, but I was, you know, I'd hang out in Leytonstone because all my friends were there, you know, so parties, lunches, dinners, drinking, dancing, falling over, all those things happened in one of those roads or other.
So, like, what were the circumstances in which you went to the Leytonstone area? And what year was it, actually?
What year is it? No idea.
Oh, and then, sorry, I wasn't very articulate. What I meant was, I suppose you're saying you was often up and down there anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And was that to go and see your friends and drink in the Northcote and things like that?
Yeah, that's the reason for going there.
Yeah. So, what kind of, how was this piece of work that you did in the Herzig, Sight Unseen?
Yeah.
How did that kind of come about?
Well, that didn't come about until the end. When Acme had to get the artist to vacate the houses, you know, put an end to the social life, put an end to, you know, everything really in terms of that kind of orbit of friends in that particular place together. And I tried to get permission from Acme to make installations or kind of wall drawings in the houses that were empty because they're going to be demolished and pulled down. But because of the crusties and because of the protest, they were very reluctant to do that. There was a very big procedure when the artist gave over their key. They'd be met by security. The security would take the key off them. There'd be sometimes the police would be there as well. Then the builder would turn up and brick up the doors and windows. Then someone would sit there until the cement went off, and then that'd be the house sealed up. So Acme just thought it'd be just too much to have someone there knocking, you know, six bells out of the walls and things. So they said they denied me permission. But I thought that it was such a good idea to do this and such a great opportunity. I had this idea in my head, this conceptual idea of making these works. And I just thought, well, I'm not going to take no for an answer. So I broke into the houses and made the work anyway.
So I just want to go back to your familiarity
mm-hmm.
with the area. Begin with. So, who were the people that you knew living in the area?
Well, Martin Mitchell, Kitty, his wife, partner, Cornelia Parker, Gary Stevens, Mina Thornton, Georgina Carlos. You name names now, I probably would say, yeah, I remember them. I mean, just loads and loads and loads of people.
Mm. Was that like where a lot of those people you went to art school with and so forth?
Only Gary Minner. I mean, the rest you know, I just know from, probably met them there actually, some of them, you know.
Oh, so was it Gary you initially visited?
Gary and Georgina, also Mark Thomas, Anita, Steve Nelson. I mean, it's just loads of people. I mean, really.
Because You also did that show, didn't you, with Steve Nelson in France?
In?
Was it Paris? I don't know if you remember that show. They had a photographer, French photographer, who came to Leighton to photograph the area. And it was all about artists in East London.
Oh, yeah, called Mind the Gap.
That's it.
Yeah.
Was that before or after Sight Unseen?
Oh, before.
Okay.
I've probably got the book here, actually.
Okay. So could you tell me a little bit more just about the people that you used to visit up in the Leighton Stone area, like what their work was, or anyone that kind of really stands out in your mind?
They all do, really. I mean, you know, because, you know, Condi was making work and struggling, everyone's struggling making work and trying to get, you know, kind of, you know, making a breakthrough, and it was just a very good social time, creative time, I think. You know, there was no, but I mean, everyone was just doing, I mean, we weren't really making art, we were just making life, you know. And so we weren't really thinking about being artists in a funny kind of way.
That's really interesting. I think that's really sort of symptomatic of the time, actually.
Mm.
Do you mean like a lot of people sort of making and getting, you know, sort of work, even just sort of earning a living and just doing work on artwork on the side? Or,
well, I think, yeah. I can't remember what we did, but we all made work on the side. I mean, we just did other jobs, and either people taught, or they kind of, you know, I was doing van driving or general building work, or, you know, we were all just getting by and kind of helping each other, I mean, you know, without even thinking about what it meant, you know, kind of.
Mm.
But the art was there, people were having shows and people were interested in. I think, did Grayson Perry live there?
Yeah.
I mean, there's still kind of people doing stuff and different parts of the place, and you hear about people, you know, and but it was just a very good, you know, the fact that everyone was together made a big difference, you know, because, you know, obviously with the Northcote pub, and everyone would go there, and so it's always like, it was a community, you know, and that's not often you get that in London, you know, so I think it was quite unique at that time in that place.
Mm. So, I mean, do you think, because there, you know, there were a number of places where Acme had these live-work spaces right across East London and up in Artway and whatever. But, you know, do you think that's all kind of finished now?
I think, well, it was probably because of the housing. I mean, we're in where I lived in Bow. I mean, our street, which was a derelict street for most of the time, you know, for at least half the time I was there. It's only artists and squatters live there, you know. You know, we had the, you know, next door were painters, filmmakers, musicians. The, you know, in Bruce Road opposite, we had musicians there. And at the end of our street, we had the Grey Organisation. Remember them? The Grey? They're called the Grey Organisation, and they just, the group of guys, they just, I don't know what they did, but they, people would knock on the door and say, you got any black paint I can borrow, you know. So people, you know, you had that kind of thing where it wasn't just sugar and milk, it was, you know, materials and stuff. You know, and because it was an empty street, you know, I remember, you know, certain times we'd just drag a piano out in the middle of the street and start banging it about, you know, kind of. But then, you know, the area got gentrified, so suddenly, you know, now it's a little kind of, you know, flower pots and stuff, and everything can. But at one point, you know, no one came down that street because they were terrified of, you know, the dogs and the squatters and the artist. And I'm sure, like in, you know, where was it? In Spanby Road and those places further west. You know, the same thing, same communities there, you know, kind of Kerry Traingrove and Alison and all those people. So there were these pockets of stuff because Acme had houses to give people rather than studios. And I think houses by nature are more social and everything, you know, where, you know, I did have a studio, an Acme studio for a while in Osborne Road, and it was very unsocial. I mean, it's just because, you know, people have freshest time, and they kind of, when they get to their studio, they just want to work. They don't want a party, a coffee, or whatever. So you understand that, but it does, you know. And I think it's a shame, but you see, the studio blocks don't have that same thing. I think it was rare that, you know, I don't know now whether there are kind of pockets of artists living in the same place, but.
So when you went up to Leytonstone, what streets did you kind of frequent where people lived?
Some I can't remember, Grove Green Road, Philibrook Road, and there's a few other roads back from Grove Green Road, whatever they were called.
Dyson
Road, yeah. Georgina lived there, and Steve, I think. There's another one further down, I think.
Colville Road.
Maybe, it was just packed full of people.
Remember, like, which was the first house that you went into? I mean, even the street name, and describe from there.
Well,
what you did to the house and so forth, and what it was like, what the house was like when you entered.
Well, they were empty. I mean, the thing was, I said to me I broke in, but I didn't really break in, because actually, all the artists that gave me their houses did it as a favour, but we had to kind of go via. We couldn't admit this to ACME, so if anyone found out, I'd have to claim that I broke in. But I just think, well, I was kind of given the key by the artist just before they left, and I would do the stuff and then give it back. So it was a way of illegally being there, kind of with consent in a way, at least consent from the artist, not the. And most of the houses, you know, houses I'd actually sat in and drank in and slept in, you know, whereas time. So they were quite kind of close to me. You know, I knew the rooms. And I just liked, I mean, this is an idea I had to make these wall works, and I had no idea whether it'd work or not. So for me, the great thing was I could just do this stuff in private. No one would see it. If it didn't work, then it was fine. And I get a chance to explore and to experiment. And I think at the very end, I did get some people to come and see it, but most of the time through, I didn't. And I photographed just for my own kind of snapshots, really. And I'm really grateful to myself for doing that, because now it's become the archive. But I wasn't that interested in photographing it, and I'm still not that interested in archiving anything. And I ought to be, because it's ephemeral, most of my work.
Because I remember quite often at the time, and it might seem strange to some people now, is people would make work and often not document it, and then later the work gets destroyed or left somewhere or whatever. And so I don't think there was this kind of, I suppose, drive all the time to document, you know, in the same way. It just seems things have changed.
Well, to one degree, we were kind of like, but also we had no idea what'd come next. You know, we didn't think what would be next. We just thought, this is now, and we do stuff. And, you know, like anything, you just deal with what you have to deal with, you know. I mean, nobody thought anything about that, I don't think.
So, like, could you kind of describe the interior of the houses? Because, I mean, for example, I'd heard about the Philibrook Road houses and that they were quite big, but I don't know any more about them than that, like from what you can remember those houses were like.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure what period they were. They weren't Victorian, were they? They must have been Edwardian, I guess, or something. But they're big, I mean, compared to Grove Green Road, which are more normal-sized houses. They were much just bigger, really. But I mean, they're really ordinary houses. I mean, fireplaces, you know, skirting boards. But that's the kind of house you might see in Islington, actually. That kind of extra foot here or there, you know. And they were big rooms, and, you know, I mean, they're very generous spaces to live in, I think.
Were the hallways quite grand, or?
I don't know, I remember particularly. But you have to go up to walk up to them, so they must have had a. I don't remember them having basements, but they must have had something, because you did walk up to them, I think. Mm. But they had big, big back gardens. Huge back gardens. And I can't remember a back garden being anything other than a huge forest. You didn't kind of cut your way through. Do you remember that? I don't think anyone ever did anything with their garden.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, can you sort of, like, describe the pieces that you did?
Well, I went in there with that plan, really. I just thought, I'm just going to just see what happens. So I just, you know, on one piece, one thing I discovered was, which I discovered previously and why I had the idea to do it, was that plaster was put on in different levels. So there'd be a kind of base level, or kind of a second level, then a finishing level. And then you've got the bare brick beneath it. So I was just cutting back into that. So I just kind of quite precisely chipped away. So on some pieces, one piece called layers, where I just simply cut back three or four layers and each just exposed it. I mean, really, I was just exposing what was there. And it's something which I'm still doing now, and in the paper works that I work, and everything is about just cutting through and getting into the interior of it, in a way, or back to the sort of whatever the surface might be, what's beneath that surface. And I take things like buckets, or anything that was like a shape I might like, or so I took kind of reference in bits and pieces that I found in the space. And what the whole point for me was that no one would see the work, so I could do what I want. I can fuck up and foul and nobody would know. I could experiment and try new things out. And I could find out what the material does. If it's the harder the material, the easier it is to carve it. The softer the plaster, the more difficult it falls off. And kind of. So I just enjoyed getting there with the drawing pad and just making up things along. Sometimes I didn't draw until afterwards. I just see what, you know, if too much falls off, I do change my plan. What's important for me was that it set in motion a kind of process that I'm still working on right now, which is, you know, I still experiment. Every single show I do is experiment. You know, I always push things a bit further than my, you know, what we call it now is a comfort zone, but, you know, I just extend the area that you know and go a bit further. And
which I think is in the Philip Road house. I got a postcard through my door of that image from Camden Art Centre years later. I think it was from Camden Art Centre.
No, the Adam Gallery, I think.
Adam Gallery. And when I first saw it, I thought it was the outline of a fireplace cut into the plaster. But then later I thought it looked like the top of a classical plinth.
Hmm.
So where did you get that image from?
A bit of both. I mean, I think the area that I took it from was an area where there was a radiator. They'd been taken out for kind of recycling or whatever. Hmm. And so I think the skirting board wasn't painted the same colour as... I was interested in columns, which later on I took on in another way, in another place. But at the time, it was that thing of being a fireplace at the top of a column. It was just that ambiguous.
Mm. And was that work developed was it the British Museum?
Mm-hmm.
Could you say something about that piece of work? Because that was a little bit sort of hit and run. Like,
yeah.
The Leytonstone.
Well, a friend of mine's worked there. As a designer, and he knew my work, and in fact he saw the work at the Adam Gallery, which is the first time I showed the work from it was a direct connection between that work I made in Leytonstone, which is 95 was the first time I had a solo show, was at Adam Gallery, and from that lots of things came out of that, and one thing was the British Museum. He saw the work, said there's going to be a big room, it's going to be refurbished at the British Museum, room 49. And if I wanted to come along and do an installation there, you know. So we thought, but we had to do it within I think, 5 weeks. And we realised, or he realised, that it would be impossible to get permission to do it. So the best thing we could do is just do it. Because, like all those institutions, if you've got confidence to walk somewhere and ask somebody for a key, and you're wearing workman's clothes and stuff, you get through. So we began the whole process of making this project. And, you know, I had a huge space to work in. And I just put a request and said I needed a scaffolding tower, and it would arrive the next day. And kind of, so it was fantastic. And nothing was written down, so no one could trace it. There's no paper trail. And eventually, when they did find out, and we could have a private view, they tried to stop it. But they realised it'd gone too far because it'd been on the in the press and on the radio, so they decided that the best way to stop it was to simply ignore it.
Oh, and what did you actually do in that room? What did you do to the room?
Well, the wall was a huge wall, and the piece I made was 35 feet long by 17 feet high. And the thing about the British Museum that caught my attention first of all was that it's just columns. At the front of it, it's just columns. You take away the columns and there's no design to it, really. Mm. The architect of that was a guy called Smirk.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great name for an architect. Not good enough for anybody. So the column was the most important. And I knew from history that Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital in the reading room. And I thought, well, the British Museum is really a great place to have written that piece of work because it is about capital. It's about what you do when you have too much and how you spend it. So I called the piece Capital, and I found out that the top of a column is called Capital. So it just made sense to make this very, very enormous and carve it in. So I got some photographs of and drawings of capitals, and I just simply drew them every single day. I just drew them and drew them and drew them and drew them and kept drawing until eventually I scaled it up and scaled it up. So the last one I did was 9 feet long. And then I thought, now I can do it. So I didn't want to square the wall up and leave marks on the wall. So what I did was imagined the large 9-foot drawing on the wall and then marked where I thought things should go, like the spiral or the top, and then did it that way. So it's.
So were you drawing with a pencil or were you carving?
First of all, just drawing with a pencil. Just 2 weeks of drawing, and then with lots of weeks of drawing on paper. But I needed to get familiar with the image to a point where I could do it without thinking. You know, I could just do it without even looking at one.
And then you drew that onto the wall eventually?
Drew onto the wall, and then started to cut into the wall.
Oh, okay. So, because he wasn't really officially allowed in the space, did you find out what happened when you went? Because were they renovating that room?
Oh yeah, they planned to strip all the plaster off. So I wasn't doing anything. There wasn't a vandal there. You know, they already decided to do that, which is why I was doing what I did. So eventually it got completely stripped off.
Mm. And going back again, because you mentioned the Adam Gallery in 1995, and that you did your first solo show. Was that documentation of sight unseen?
No, that was completely different. I mean, it was the same thing, you know, cutting into the walls. And Adam Reynolds, who ran the gallery, was, you know, not only gave me my first chance, really, but was incredibly supportive. I mean, you know, galleries and museums since then have always been slightly worried when I'm going to cut into the wall. But Adam just was quite happy with it. You know, he said, well, we know plaster, we can fix it quite easy. It was no problem. So his faith and his... You know, he was influential, I think, in lots of artists' work. The work was, and also I got my first review there, because I sent slides of the work I did in Leytonstone,
yeah,
to Sarah Kent, and told her that the show's came up at Adam Gallery, so she came and saw the work in progress when I was doing it, and she wrote a review and a really nice review, and it was the first time I got a review.
Yeah, and I suppose what I want as well now is just a little bit more detail about the houses, because you mentioned the Fullybrook Road, and then you said that you went into three houses. What streets were they on?
I think two in Grove Green Road and one in, I think.
And there was definitely one in Fullybrook Road, because the imaging, the space is so big.
Yeah.
So how long did you work in those houses for?
I just had a few days before, in between the handover of the key, so really, I just really had, you know, a day, 2 days.
That's amazing, because it looks like a really big piece.
That worked fast. I was only caught once there by the security. That's the other thing I had to work for. Oh, they just kind of came in. They just suddenly heard me banging away there and kind of and came rushing in because I was standing there with my tool belt on, a huge hammer and a chisel, covered in dust. And they just looked at me, just, you know, even though I must have been half the size of them, they just terrified and ran out again. Yeah. And that's why I was also working fast, because I didn't know when I'd be stopped, you know.
Yeah.
So,
So that was the, was that the only close shave?
Yeah.
Because the other times, did you just lock up the house and go away and give the keys back to the artists and they drop them into Acme?
Yep.
So even, because that was 1994, so, you know, from what you was describing, it was such a big deal when people left the houses and someone came to pick them up. Did the artists have to wait by the house, or did they just drop the keys into the office?
I remember there being very like a kind of relay. You know, the key would be handed over, someone would take the key, and someone, you know, it was because they were terrified of the clusters getting in and squatting.
Yeah.
So they had a very strict, you know, very strict procedure to make sure that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, with the big scaffolding tower.
Yeah, can you describe?
I've got pictures of that too.
Great.
So, no, it was a wonderful piece of sculpture, really, or not a sculpture, but it's a wonderful installation. It's this climbing, gigantic scaffolding tower going up there. Mm. I remember, all that time there were lots of press around and lots of TV people around, lots of protesters and stuff. But the whole area was, I mean, the whole Link Road was kind of, you know, a huge, you know, debate about that nationally.
Mm. And because you'd been going down the area and seeing your friends over the years, I mean, what kind of period are we talking about that you was kind of going in and out of the area?
I really can't remember. I mean, it's just anything before 94, 90, you know, 5 years, 6 years period before then.
Yeah. Over that period, you would have seen...
Probably 1988.
Yeah.
89.
So you would have seen quite a lot of change to the streets.
Since then, yeah.
Yeah, and like, because I want to get a sense of, like, what it kind of looked like towards the end, really.
Well, I don't remember it being much. I mean, you just lost roads and roads and roads. Suddenly you lose a whole road, you know. I mean, it just became... You know, and everyone began to move out bit by bit. You know, it just stopped being the centre of everyone's life, or what, you know, and just faded out, really. Because the protesters took over the sort of area, in a way, so...
That's interesting. And, because when you was up in Philibrook Road, was, like, half the street knocked down, or part of it, or hadn't it got to that stage yet?
I think it was. Yeah, there were bits of it knocked down. I remember there were bits of it knocked down. I got photographs of it actually, of parts being knocked down. I mean, they would not knock it down as soon as they could, you know. So yes, I remember that. But you know, lots of corrugated iron, lots of odd houses staying still there, you know, while people are protesting and fighting, you know.
Can you remember that
paint, I mean, people would paint interiors, they paint pictures over the inside of it, outside of it. It just got kind of, you know, just like any, you know, when squatters are in somewhere and they kind of, and they're hanging on, holding on, you know, I think they tried their hardest, you know, not to get too rough because they didn't want the press coverage, you know, so the authorities were kind of smart about how they, or creepy about how they did all that, but I mean, people held out.
So you're talking about Claremont Road and the last house at Philibrook Road?
You know, I can't remember that clearly. All over the place, really. I mean, there's bits of houses here and bits of houses there pulled down.
Down Grove Green Road and Philibrook Road, some of them are like quite formal, like rectangular, quite minimal in a way. And then you've got the ones which, like the one that looks like a fireplace in the top of a classical cliff. And they're all sort of very much in that formal vein. And then you get to the saw, the one that's called saw, and the other one, stretched flag.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Well, I think that one thing I guess if I think about it, everything that I am now was in that work, in that, you know, I work in different media and I work in different, even within the media, I work in different ways. So maybe I might work with video in a quite sculptural way, kind of Naumann-like way. Or I make kind of narrative film, you know, and I think that I've never been ever felt that I was a figurative artist or abstract artist. It never really, it was never a label that I ever felt I needed to attach to myself, one or the other. I mean, what I kind of have is a bit like what Richter says, I have no style, no continuity, no sense of anything, really. I just make work.
Mm.
And there are things that you have to respond to, or you want to respond to in an abstract way or concrete way, and other times you kind of, in a more narrative way. With the piece Saw, it was actually at belly height. And I remember hearing about bed sores, and I was horrified, you know, that bed sores can happen that way, that you can, just by simply someone being in bed for a long time, can destroy the tissue there, and you know, there'd be a hole inside that person, where you can, you know, you, it's, and later on I actually worked in a hospital and saw them, you know.
Same way that pressure, like the weight of something. In one place.
Actually, it was before then. I worked in a hospital.
Oh.
That's right. I worked before in the late 70s, and saw bed sores and saw people in bed. I worked in a hospital for a year and in a hospice for a year and a half. And seeing people's sores being dressed, and it was really like a kind of huge hole. I mean, it was like almost the size of an egg cup. And I'd see nurses just putting in, you know, bandage and stuff and wadding into that kind of sore. And just the idea that that kind of wound can happen just by simply someone laying down. So in that piece, Saw, I just kind of imagined, because the layer of, you know, the different layers in the plaster that I mentioned before, just cutting through that just very gently, very thinly, almost at the same height as the belly. Almost as someone been leaning against it for a long, long time, and just gradually wore away. I remember a quote by Quentin Crisp. I'm not sure if I remembered it then or whether I've had it since then, but he said that he tried to get through into society, and you can do two things: you can keep knocking against the door, or just lean against it. And if you lean against it, eventually it falls through. And I think that idea that you don't always have to be, you know, pushing something, just leaning might be enough. So that's how that piece came about, really.
And I suppose that idea of waiting as well, which I'm just sort of, because that's what a lot of the protesters did, actually. Waiting on the roots or corners, and not actually really doing very much, but that sort of presence, really. I mean, I don't know, because when I see that piece, I mean, I just sort of think of, like, also what was happening to the whole environment, like, you know, that all those buildings being knocked away, and this sort of whole place being scarred and mowed down, and it's sort of, I don't know, just that little piece on that wall seems to encapsulate the whole place in a sort of subliminal way. I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Well, you're reading your own things. I mean, I didn't think they were there for me. But I think that's what is interesting about art, is that, you know, people can, you know, often you do things without really, you know, they develop a meaning later, perhaps.
Mm.
The stretched flag piece began
because... Union Jack.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the protesters had made a flag out of the negative colours, you know. And then another person had used. And it was just so interesting to take the flag and then by doing a simple switch to make something, make the flag quite a different thing to kind of grab, to rehab. And at that particular point in history, you know, the Union Jack was not, you know, it was not a union Jack, it was a kind of diversity of Jack. Kind of, you know, anyone that had, you know, Union Jack was really about kind of the right wing and the BNP party and the National Front. So for a long time, you know, the Union Jack was not an object you'd ever brandish without it having implications that you didn't want to have.
Yeah.
So I wanted, and I'm also a big fan of Jasper John's work and his work, Flag, the American Flag. And one night when I was doing that project, I was in town and saw this stretched limousine trying to get its way around the corners of London, less cumbersome, bizarre thing. I just thought, oh, that's interesting that it's been stretched like this. I just thought, well, okay, I wonder if I can stretch the flag to the point where not only is it longer than it should be, but that it has the kind of bare skeleton of its logo. And that was the other thing about it, was the logo, you know, that it became a kind of, it's the logo for the country, you know, it's the trademark UK, is, you know, the Union Jack. So I was interested in that as well, that aspect. I used the Union Jack a few times, actually. I did a painting that was about the Augury, the miners' strike.
Yeah.
Because a lot of my work at that time was about those kind of issues, so I made this big painting about the miners' strike and used a flag for that, and sort of dripped on it and scarred it and washed it off. And so I'd used the flag a few times in drawings and in paintings, and then this time in the sculpture or wall drawing.
Late 80s, 90s, and I remember Keith Piper did that piece called There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack, and I think some curator organised a big show about work with Union Jacks, but I can't quite place it actually at the moment. But I don't know, I just think maybe that was so much kind of the time.
Well, it's about identity, you know, it's about what group you're part of, you know. I think when the crosses took that, you know, the negative colours of the Union Jack and played with the colours of it and everything, they kind of grabbed their own identity. But they used the one that was meant to be the authority of the establishment and used it to represent the people that were kind of off-centre. I don't mean off-centre, I mean, you know, on the edges. And I thought that's a great tactic, to kind of take what's familiar and subvert it, you know, because subversion has to be that. I mean, you can't subvert subversion. I mean, you have to subvert what's established.
Yeah. And also, I remember you mentioned Terry Trengrave.
Hmm.
Because he did that piece at the Acme Gallery where he tunnelled through the building. And, like, I suppose also with your work, you're doing the same, like using the house as material or using the building as material. And you mentioned, because, I mean, I was thinking also that the notion of, like, there's tools in your work, there's kind of this industrial feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered where that comes from, actually.
It comes from my background. I mean, from working class background, doing jobs, you know, involving, you know, manual labour jobs, you know, where you have to be good at something, you know, or you get your fingers cut off, you know, so you need to know to use hammers and chisels and stuff. I think also from the very beginning, you know, from growing up in the East End, you didn't really see much art. And the first time I got taken to an art gallery, in fact, twice I got taken when I was 15 and just 15 and a half. One was to the Commonwealth Institute. It was a kind of educational trip that the school made, and which didn't really interest me very much. But in the foyer was these sculptures by what later found out to be Anthony Cairo sculpture. It's kind of a long, I-frame, I-beams, you know, the kind of industrial, you know, bits that, you know, that he uses and used then. And I was just amazed by it. I was knocked out, these kind of, you know, they've been painted orange, and I knew the materials, I'd seen them in building sites and stuff, but I asked my teacher what it was. He said, it's sculpture. And I said, but I thought sculpture was statues, you know. And I, up to that point, I thought sculpture was statues. When you saw a statue, that was what sculpture is. And I just thought, this is fantastic, because I can do this. But I didn't mean that in a cynical way. I just thought, this is a material that I understood and recognised. And I had the same thing when I saw, first saw Carl Andre's work, and saw, you know, using bricks and, you know, objects which I'm familiar with. Like, there was no bronzeware where I came from. There's no paintings where I came from. You know, I didn't see that stuff daily, but I saw bricks daily.
So when you was younger and you was looking at this artwork in that way, was it like people in your family were builders or something? Like, how, or was you, had you done building work then?
I'd done building work, but, you know, just familiar with it. I mean, you know what brick looks like, you know. You know what a steel girder looks like, you know. I mean, these are things you've seen, you know. And they make sense to the industry that, you know, your parents probably earn a living from in some way or other, or which the area earns a living from, you know.
Right.
So,
So what kind of jobs did your family do, like your mum and dad?
That was a plumber, then he became an heating engineer, then he became a manager of a swimming pool.
Right.
Mother was a seamstress, still is kind of a seamstress.
Okay.
She, you know, so the rag trade, really.
Did you do like building work as a job and then go to art school, or did you go straight from school to foundation?
I left school at 15, went straight into work, worked for Polydor Records,
yeah.
General labouring, just taking records out of the, you know, packaging them up and sending them off to shops. That was what I did. And then my mother insisted that I go to college in somewhere or other, so I went to Havering College doing window display and exhibition design, and then was thrown out after 3 months. And then the person threw me out felt a bit guilty, I think, and so she got me an interview in East End Foundation course, which I thought was a building course, because it seemed to make sense. Your foundation, you start, well, you know, you learn how to do your foundation, and you learn to do the walls, and you learn to do the roof. Yeah.
How interesting.
So I went there and got an interview. They looked at all my drawings and I just thought, it's a bit weird. I suppose you've got to draw things. You've got to draw walls and stuff and foundations and stuff. And then I could tell from the fact, you know, as soon as I got there, I knew it wasn't quite right because they were wearing velvet jackets and stuff. And that wasn't what I thought builders would wear. And then I found out about Duchamp and Picasso and, you know, and everything. And it was just, you know, it was like suddenly finding a whole world of amazing things, you know, and I still enjoy finding out about things.
Mm. That's really interesting, like how it all is sort of fed in.
Mm.
And in a way, because that Sight Unseen piece you said was quite a linchpin for your recent work.
Mm.
Anyway, can you say how?
Because, you know, when I do shows now, no matter where the shows are, I do two things. I treat the smallest, tiny artist-run space as if it was a Tate Gallery or a Museum of Modern Art in New York. And I treat big museums as if they were like the smallest, tiny artist-run space in Leytonstone. You know, I just treat them exactly the same. You know, and I tend to experiment every time I do a show. It's a nightmare for the curators and for anyone writing press releases, because I have no idea what I'm doing until I get there. And I resist the idea of making press release because I don't know, I might change my mind at the very last minute, and I often do. And so it set in my idea, because what happened in Leytonstone was I could do what I wanted to do, to experiment. I just thought, this is the right way to be. I thought, I don't want to stop doing it. I don't want to start being good at something and then just do it, because it'd be boring. And I still find doing shows really boring. I mean, it's nothing more boring than putting your work in a gallery and then you walk away. You know, just as people start to arrive, you know. So I like the idea of engagement. I like the idea of just talking to people and people see the work and changing it. And I change work all the time. I fiddle with it. You know, even films I've made, I keep changing them and altering them. You know, I never really finished anything.
Yeah. And also, what I was going to ask you was, when you... What art school did you go to? When did you end? When did you graduate?
Thrown out of Havering, went the second term at East End Foundation,
yeah.
But I was 16 at that point, so I was too young to do the main foundation. I did a preliminary foundation.
Yeah.
Then the following year, did a full foundation. Then I did, then you just like you meant to apply for, and I went. I looked at Cardiff. I looked at a few places. I went there in a kind of coach for the school, and I just picked on Goldsmiths because it's the simple, it's the easiest one. It was local, so I didn't even go there. I just simply applied and went there for an interview, and just took, because I didn't have a portfolio. I just had a suitcase. I took my suitcase packed full of drawings and notebooks. I wrote notebooks all the time. I went for the interview, and Richard Wentworth was on the panel, thank God, you know. And he said, as soon as I arrived with a suitcase, he just thought, this is the kind of person we want.
So, you did your, was it your BA at Goldsmiths?
Uh-huh.
Did you do a postgrad, or did you?
Eventually, yeah. I applied to Chelsea, didn't get in, after about a five-year gap or something. They ended up going to Birmingham, doing MA Birmingham, which was good and bad.
And then, was it after Birmingham that you came back to the East End?
Yeah.
And so, like, when did you sort of move into your place in East London?
Must have been 86.
Okay. And I think you said that Sight Unseen was the first piece that you'd done in a space or something that you weren't really showing.
Well, I didn't show anywhere. I couldn't get a show if I paid loads of money for it. I just couldn't get my work anywhere, really. I applied to Whitechapel Open, you know, every year. You know, every year I got rejected, which I kind of, you know, minded and didn't mind. I just felt it was sort of like my local gallery, my local space. I'm an EastEnder, you know. I felt like I should apply for it because that's, you know, and you know, the rejection is just something that you got to live with. I lived with that all my life, you know, so. It's different now than it was then, really. Just different kinds of rejections.
And then you eventually did get some work in the Whitechapel Open, didn't you?
Yeah. One occasion. Once I got in, decided that was it, I wouldn't do it again.
What year was that?
96.
And what did you show?
Actually, I showed... That particular year they opened was in different spaces. It was in the commercial space that Keith Ball organised, and he was one of the selectors, so I think it's the reason why I kind of, and Richard Wentworth too was one of the selectors too, so I think that's another reason why, you know, Richard was good. The area it was shown as the commercial was in Spitalfields, so my mum was born in Bethnal Green in that area and worked as a seamstress there. My early memories of her is a sewing. And so I got these labels, you know these labels, those name labels you can get? I got this company called Cash, that was the name of the company, to get lots of labels made with my name on it, different colours. So on the wall of the gallery, I just simply put a big metre square with pins, just making pins, these name tags with my name. Because the thing about the Open was everyone's trying to make a name for themselves, so I thought I'd make my own name for myself, yeah. And put these up, and I sold them off the wall, so people could buy them off the wall. And take it away with them, so I think that's £3.50 or something.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, if I sold the whole lot, I'd make a lot of money, I'd make hundreds of pounds or something. I think I sold eight or something.